But what's interesting about drugs, of course, is that they reveal an entire social and political landscape, that it's always about more than drugs. In the introduction of the book, in addition to sort of outlining the basic narrative, I also offer five orienting claims. And one of the last one is just that drug policy is not about drugs. Like, when people talk about drugs, they're always talking about something more than drugs.
Welcome. I'm Ben Boyce. This is the Dr. Junkie Show. And today I have a conversation with author and academic Ben Fong, whose new book called Quick Fixes, Drugs in America from Prohibition to the 21st Century Binge is now available on Amazon or wherever you buy books. And I totally recommend it. We'll dig into his main points today, and we'll cover a lot, including public opinion of alcohol in America throughout different historical eras, amphetamine and methamphetamine popularity in America throughout the early 1900s, SSRIs like Prozac and the false promise of permanent yet daily chemical repair of one's mind, psychedelics and the so-called psychedelic renaissance, religion and our current understanding of the mind, and we'll ground all of these topics in basic critical media theory, or what I often call communication theory. Which brings me to one piece of business I ought to cover before the interview begins. Capitalism, or rather, how we'll use that term throughout this episode. Of course, if you know me, if you've listened to this podcast, you know I'm someone who's read Marx and Hegel, Sam Harris, and Tupac. All people who have helped me shape my understanding of capitalism and the larger systems it props up and works alongside. But if you know that about me, then you also know I kind of enjoy and appreciate many of the privileges of living in a capitalist society. Cheap weed, always available drugs no matter how illegal they are, cheeseburgers and french fries, light beer and NASCAR. I'm a sucker for a good time. Capitalism isn't all bad. In many ways, it improves our quality of life compared to most systems of values and cultural norms which preceded it. But that doesn't mean it's perfect or that it comes without problems. In fact, like Marx said, the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle. That means no matter when in history you look, if there were poor people and rich people, if both groups existed, well then the major struggles within that society were based on their differing values and goals. So today we'll talk about those problems, those class struggles, those differing values and goals of the rich and poor. And we'll use critical theory, which, I'll remind you, isn't about shredding a system so much as it's about explaining all parts of a system, including those that might not always be especially enjoyable to talk about. The critical researcher often appreciates or even loves the systems they critique. Otherwise, we wouldn't bother critiquing them. But just because I love cheeseburgers doesn't mean I can't also acknowledge the problems of an all-cheeseburger diet or the environmental damage caused by industrial farming. So to keep it simple, capitalism, as we use the term in this episode, simply means a system whereby manufacturers produce, advertise, and sell products to consumers while simultaneously competing with one another for market share. Capitalism is that system that most of us know so well that it just feels like the way things are, and that sometimes means it's hard to spot. But we'll spot it a lot today. With that basic setup, welcome Ben Fong. I've been thinking like there's a lot of ways to come at today, but I think we should probably start with the book. And I always start by saying, do you want to just introduce yourself? Because people always have a bit more of a perspective on themselves than I do. With you, I guess I should say, can you introduce yourself with the knowledge that I'm about to steer us through a lot of communication theory as we go through your book? I imagine there's a lot of ways to read a book like this, but my PhD is in communication, and this just felt like Frankfurt School critical media theory, a lot of stuff that built the framework. So,
I mean, at the end of the day, the book was written, I'll try not to do too much interview material right now, but it was sort of just written because I've noticed that a lot of people are on drugs, and then after some research found out that a lot of people are on drugs. And so it's fairly simple. And I would say like not so well-rooted in previous biography, but I could probably spin up something that's interesting enough.
Oh, I'll poke at that a little bit too, because there's a few descriptions in here that we don't have to start with, but that we definitely have to come around to at some point, particularly regarding cocaine, that just sound like they have to be somewhat autobiographical. But again, take that as a teaser.
Sure.
So do you want to just tell us who you are? It looked to me from your bio like you're still a grad student right now, but in a PhD program, right?
No. So I teach at Arizona State University. I've taught there for like 7 years. I am an honors faculty fellow, which is a fairly unique designation there. I teach in the Honors College. I'm also the associate director at the Center for Work and Democracy at ASU. And yeah, I've been at work on this book for a few years now. Very happy that it's out.
Good. I'm glad I asked. I don't know what I must have bumped into that looked, and maybe it was a really old page that was from back in your grad school days and I didn't look close enough, but I was feeling incredibly inadequate that you've done so much work that intersects with what I do. And I'm like, are you kidding me? That this guy should be a head faculty somewhere. So that makes me feel a little bit better.
Well, thanks for saying that.
Yeah. So one of the ways to think about, like I said, I'm going to swerve us through some of the what I think of as like the framework and the foundation of the book, but the title is interesting. It's called Quick Fixes. The subtitle, you got the subtitle in front of you. This is interesting. I left your book behind me. I have my headphones in.
It's Quick Fixes. Subtitle is Drugs in America, From Prohibition to the 21st Century Binge.
So it's got this double entendre, meaning that really doesn't come fully together until like the conclusion of the book, but is it worth talking a little bit about where that term came from?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that, well, one, the quick fix is a unique Americanism, and so I wanted something that captures something about the American experience. But I think in both in terms of drug consumption and drug policy, drugs have essentially served as a quick fix to cover over broader social ills. So in the realm of drug consumption, I sort of detailed the numbers in the introduction of the book, but Americans are really in the midst of this world historic drug binge. And it's not just the most sort of well-known features, so the opioid crisis and associated deaths of despair, but it's kind of everything. It's marijuana, amphetamines, benzodiazepines, antidepressants, antipsychotics. Across the board, Americans are taking more drugs than ever, and the trends are all going upward. Why is that? You know, there's a lot of factors involved, but it's really difficult not to see drug consumption as something of a quick fix to deal with the broad range of social and political issues that we're dealing with at the present. And what's interesting about the United States and why I wrote the book is that it's kind of been that way for over a century. Basically, since the late 19th century, the United States has been uniquely obsessed with both consuming drugs and with demonizing drugs at the same time. So it's an essential paradox about the United States in particular. Yeah.
Well, and it felt to me like in the end, this is where I'll swerve into some of the theory that the book's built on, that you also add this second piece of quick fix, which is, I've called it this clunky term called chronic wokeness. Every 10 years in the United States, like clockwork, we notice a massive problem. We act like we fixed it. We don't fix it well enough. We all hit the streets in protest, and then we go on about our lives. And then 10 years later, we have police brutality. We have an issue. And the quick fix to me was a statement that at the end you made the connection that you'd made throughout, only put it into words, that this is just one more way of many that the United States has fallen into its own patterns. We want to look like the best country in the world, but man, y'all, that'd be a lot of work. So let's just polish it up, get it fixed good enough to work till tomorrow and keep moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So it's both in the realm of drug consumption and also drug policy. And I'm not the first one to say that. You know, critics of the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act said as much, that it's essentially a quick fix used for political gain and not to actually deal with problems of drug distribution and abuse in America. You know, at present, we're at a fairly interesting moment because most people understand that drug policy has been a monumental failure, right? The war on drugs has been a tragedy, both on its own terms and in terms of the sort of like perverse things that have followed from it. But we still have it. You know, we still have the largest prison system in the world and an absolutely abominable number of people in prison for nonviolent drug offenses, which is astounding given the various legalization movements happening today.
Yeah, I imagine you were, I'm sure you cited him. In fact, I'm remembering at least once where I flipped to the back to see who you were citing, and it was Richard de Grandpre. And that's what, on the shoulders of giants, as they say in any field nowadays, but that's what I felt like was one of the big theorists. And his big piece was The Cult of Pharmacology, which is this book that ends hopelessly because he essentially at the end says, just so you know, this isn't an attempt to wake the world up and to just tell the right people and we'll all change. Like, we've built this into the foundations, and even he was like, I don't much expect it to change. And it felt like you had picked up this trail and pressed it forward into a new generation and said, once again, look at how invisible the threads become when it's just daily life as usual.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be quite as pessimistic as de Grandpre in that sense. You know, I think the cult of pharmacology is just that. It's a cult. It's been a very successful cult for a few decades now. But, you know, I mean, one thing that strikes me about the current pharmaceutical regime, and we're jumping all over a little bit now, but just to talk about the pharmacological or the psychopharmacology, pharmacological industry a little bit. One thing that strikes me about the way in which people take psychiatric drugs is that it's very much still in line with the kind of older conception of psychiatry. And so, you know, if you look at the sort of like key features of psychopharmaceutical advertising after the biological revolution, psychiatry, what are its key features? Well, it's no longer, you know, the specific aspects of society or everyday life that are causing you stress that need to be dealt with. It's now pictures of neurons and little neurotransmitters going back and forth. And they say this drug helps do something or other to serotonin or norepinephrine or whatever, right? And so the implicit promise is that you're dealing with the cause of the thing. Right? You're dealing with the cause of the thing. You're not dealing with symptom relief. You're dealing with the cause, and thus the thing that you're suffering from is going to go away. I actually think that most people don't take psychiatric drugs that way. I think that they're like, I want this symptom to go away, and this thing helped me with it. And that's a fine way to take drugs, right? That's a perfectly good justification for drug taking. But it does fly in the face of what pharmaceutical companies promise, which is to deal with causes. And to me, that's actually cause for hope, which is that people haven't totally bought into the odd justifications that pharmaceutical companies throw at us.
I don't want to swerve too far in and out as we build the foundation, but you've got another paper we want to talk about today that is much the same theme with how religion and psychology and the idea of the mind was put together in the United States. And I saw these same threads running through another theorist that, if we wanted to tangent here, we don't have to too far, but would be Marshall McLuhan. And you seem to have this medium as the message theme built throughout a lot of your work that says when a new way of talking, a new way of delivering messages, a new technology, a new thing shows up in the lives of humans, it inevitably changes what it means to be a human. It changes how we talk and think about the world. And inevitably, we totally don't notice it. We just remain totally sort of stuck in the moment. And, you know, unless you look really close or you read something that challenges what you believe, the status quo of the world, this is what the real book is built upon nowadays, is what I think you use the term late stage capitalism. And if not, you use the term capitalism throughout, but you make some really interesting connections to, we're getting specific and we can do that throughout, but the big theme is that capitalism is the foundation the United States and the quote Western world was built upon hundreds of years ago. And that is not a natural state for humans to be in. And so, of course, we've always had this lust and thirst for escape, for intoxication. And it's had to fall into frameworks that say good drugs versus bad drugs, acceptable versus not acceptable. So if we wanted to fast forward, we'll come back around to where you were kind of headed, which is SSRIs, the medicalization model of the last 50 years or so. But it might do us well to sort of back the clock up to even 1800s and talk about, well, what is similar and different from how these substances have always been sold in the framework of capitalism? And why are some of them consistently or different times pushed out and said not conducive to capitalism and others seem to be taxable and acceptable?
Yeah, great. You know, a friend who read the book said that I was, that, you know, it was kind of a downer, that it sort of seems like I'm in league with the prohibitionists and in painting a sort of like negative portrait of drug use. And that's not at all what I think in a sort of trans-historical sense. I think drugs are a huge gift to human beings. I think most people, if you ask them about their drug experiences, have positive experiences to report. In that sense, I think, you know, drugs are psychoactive drugs in particular, a great, you know, benefit to humanity. What I focus on in the book, however, is the odd and somewhat depressing ways in which drugs are used in capitalist society, which has specific kinds of features, which I think kind of, you know, offer odd ways in which to use drugs that, you know, potentially could be used to plumb the depths of human experience. And instead, we're using them to adapt to the present conditions of society. The book has its own sort of story to tell in each chapter, just to sort of get to the basics a little bit. It's broken up into 9 chapters. Each chapter covers a drug or specific class of drugs. And, you know, it has its own story to tell about America in the process. But there is a kind of underlying narrative, and it's broken up into 4 different phases. And they're kind of 4 different, what social scientists call regimes of capital accumulation. So the first starts with industrial capitalism, late 19th century. The second, roughly the Fordist period, governed by the New Deal coalition. The third, the neoliberal period. And the fourth, the one that we're presently living through. In the first, you know, with gathering temperance movements and eventually prohibition in the United States, there were, you know, a broad variety of moral responses to both alcohol use as well as what they sort of improperly called narcotic use in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And this resulted, again, in prohibition, but also in global drug controls led by the United States, so the Harrison Act in 1914. And, you know, the United States comes off at the time as unique in the same way it is today. It was uniquely taking drugs in the form of a very, very well-to-do patent medicine industry. And it was also uniquely obsessed with controlling drugs as well, particularly drugs that were used by oppressed and marginalized people. So immigrants, Black people in the United States. And that produced prohibition not only here, but sort of globally. That was the beginning of international drug control. Why was that? And just to start there, I think that the United States, this is the sort of explanation I have, specifically in the alcohol chapter, I think the United States, somewhat uniquely in the Western world, did not develop the kinds of political parties and working class structures that would offer a real countervailing force to industrial capital. And this is not to blame unions or working class organizations. American labor history from the late 19th century is a bloody affair. It's absolutely brutal. Industrial capitalists were more vicious and violent than capitalist classes elsewhere. And so you didn't get the development of real countervailing political structures through which you might challenge and sort of mitigate the social ills of industrial capitalism. And as a result, you know, when you're looking about urban environments in the late 19th century, you see men, predominantly men, getting extremely drunk in these saloons, and you see people that you don't like taking substances that you're scared of. And so, you know, what is the response to all these things? Well, absent a properly political response, you get a predominantly moral response. And I think that's what really propped up the late 19th century temperance movements. It was a moral response to the social ills that industrial capitalism had wrought. And so why do you get a uniquely strong temperance movement in the United States? Well, it's because we lacked working class political opposition to industrial capitalism.
I love that we started at the beginning with alcohol. You put a figure out there that's something like the average American, including kids, through the early 19th to mid-19th century, drank an average of like 3 gallons of, or 3 liters rather, of alcohol a day, because it was just how you knew the water that it was made out of at least wasn't funky, and for a lot of other reasons. But you mentioned Fordism showing up in the 20s. There wasn't an expectation that people in the city to be productive might go punch a clock and stick their hand in a 2,000-pound press that they have to pull it out of in time and move heavy loads of stuff and not drop it. Once the system changed and it wasn't, you're on the homestead and you're bored as hell all day, but you got a farm and you got injuries that hurt, so go ahead and drink up. And it went from that to what we would call capitalism. It seems to coincide. with prohibitionism, which was likely there all along. There's always been people that said alcohol bad, that it picked up steam, and that's where the system sort of migrated to this new era, and alcohol, the old fine drug, was now on the list of no-no for those people.
Yeah, I think tellingly, you know, the temperance movement existed in fits and starts, you know, from the late 18th century, but it really only picked up as a national movement after post-bellum industrialization. I think that there's at least two reasons for that. Like, one, with industrialization and increasing urbanization, you just get much more visible instances of intoxication, right? It's just like there, right, much more visibly.
Not on the farm where you, right, you don't have to see Henry except at church every Sunday and he cleans up, right?
Exactly. And you get popular depictions of, like, you know, intoxication and the ills that it brings.
The eight steps or 12 steps, yeah, the old Puritan.
Right, right,
You end up killing yourself on the final step.
But drinking practices did change as well, as you intimated, you know. I think alcohol and also, you know, beer in particular, right, there wasn't the same kind of like liquor consumption, though it did exist. It just sort of infused social ties in a way that was less about escape and more about just sort of like communing with people around you, right? It fulfilled a sort of like role and social obligation. With industrialization, you know, people drank to drink, essentially, right? The whole function.
I'm out of work. Changed. I'm trying to get a little sloshed, as opposed to, exactly, to where you started. And I believe you do this in the book. You outline the invention of what is we think of as the bar nowadays. We aren't surprised when we go in, but we went from facing towards each other to facing towards the bartender and just hammering them down, but that they were more than just bars. They were spaces. Like we were just saying, you're out in the middle of nowhere. You're on the open plains. You don't have cars that can drive you places. And what purpose have you to come into town if you have a meeting place where you can hang out for a while? The air blows through there. There's people to talk to. It's a mercantile. There's maybe religious services in the back or other services upstairs. Again, that change that came around the end of the 19th century ushered in a whole new way we think about what bars are nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the colonial tavern was a communal space. It was, you walked in and it was tables that you sat down at, right? You were like there to talk to other people. There were other functions. You could stay there. It served as just sort of like a meeting place, whereas the bar, you could say in one sense, has a kind of instrumental purpose to it, right? You're there, you face the alcohol, you drink, you're sort of like shuffled along. Sometimes you don't even sit down. That being said, it, you know, this difference could be overstated. The saloon, like the tavern before it, did exercise in many instances a kind of social function. So it was a sort of gathering place, a place where you could get cheap beer and sort of free lunch, but also a place where you could get like peddler's permits and whatnot. It was a sort of center of working class life. And so, you know, popular depictions of the saloon, especially from the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Anti-Saloon League, you know, they of course paint the saloon as this absolutely horrible place where predominantly immigrant men go to get sloshed on the weekends, right, or after work. But it wasn't that, unsurprisingly, in a lot of cases. In a lot of cases, yes, it's a place where people drank a lot, but it was also a place where working class people could get together, one of the few sort of like communal spots in urban environments. So it wasn't, it's good not to, you know, buy into all the rhetoric of the of the prohibitionists.
Well, the foundation's always capitalism. And as you do this actually throughout the book, one of the big connections you make is between Ford-style capitalism or McDonald's-style capitalism and cocaine cartel-style capitalism. And even though many of us have heard for decades they're not that different, we still feel like they're not at all the same. And the truth is, from tobacco companies that have pulled clever tricks of capitalism and PR to cocaine cartels that figure out ways to do stuff, once capitalism shows up, that beer, not only, like you mentioned, is just one example. It not only goes from, you know, 3 or 6% beer to 80% booze, but it gets cheaper. It starts to get clever labels that make claims that aren't true. It gets sold as medicine. And unless there's checks or some sort of way to make sure people aren't getting delivered Frankfurt School messages that are convincing them of things that they might not, media that they might not other be convinced of, we're prone to end up in a place where we'll come around to when we talk later about possible solutions to these problems. It isn't just as simple as like legalize it at all and put it on the corner for free. It's got to be a much more responsible attempt than that.
Yeah, I mean, I do draw a kind of parallel between the legal drug trade and the illegal drug trade as being more similar than people would like to admit. I mean, we're ultimately dealing with a common batch of psychoactive substances, right? The thing that is in Adderall is almost chemically indistinguishable from what is in methamphetamine, right? But people have these extremely different connotations. And in fact, methamphetamine hydrochloride has been used in pharmaceutical medications for a long time, and it still is. So this sort of schizoid distinction we have between the sort of legal and illegal realms of drug use is, to my mind, kind of silly. But when I make that comparison between the industries, so on the one hand, I mean to say that the illegal drug industry, it does not operate like by a wholly, you know, different realm of rules, you know, that, like it's often portrayed in sort of like television shows. Right. It's essentially a business, right? Like you could model the heroin cocaine trades on sort of like principles you learn in business school. It's at the end of the day, nothing very sexy. It's like made into something sort of like fun for media. And there is a kind of like spectacular violence involved, but it all sort of obeys market mechanisms, right? It's all about doing the thing that puts you in the position to be the most profitable at the end of the day. Yeah. And so in that sense, I wanted to say the illegal drug trade is not so different from the legal drug trade. I also wanted to say, however, that the legal drug trade is not the ethical thing that it makes itself out to be, you know.
The hell you say.
This is actually, you know, the modern pharmaceutical industry really differentiated itself in the early 20th century from the sort of fading patent medicine industry by calling itself the ethical industry, the ethical pharmaceutical industry. Yeah. You know, I don't think we need to get too far into this, but it's, of course, anything but ethical. A lot of the sort of like key psychoactive drugs, and specifically like ADHD meds, like almost all of the companies and all the different drugs have been fined by the FDA for misleading advertising in some way. So, you know, they are not what they make themselves out to be either.
Yeah. So as we move forward from alcohol through prohibition, alcohol eventually is re-legalized in the United States, but culture in the meantime has changed. When we're talking about capitalism and Big Pharma has basically pulled the trick of saying there's a way to get you get to use this drug card, and it just means you got to go to this doctor, and it has to be a certain drug. And in all this drug war, alcohol war at times, there's been good chemicals and there's been bad chemicals, but the darndest thing is often the bad chemicals end up on the good list a few years later, and then they're slid back over the bad list. So amphetamines is one of the drugs you cover a little bit too, that we had a big boom, especially correlated with like World War I or World War II, that fueled this, also related to what was going on in culture at the time. And as you mentioned, there's still amphetamines out there, but we tend to think of them very different nowadays, at least street level, than we did back then. So maybe that's a good way to talk about what was different then, and why was it amphetamine and later benzos and barbiturates that at that time gained some popularity.
Sure. I mean, just to address that, or the last point that you made first, this odd sort of like bipolarity when it comes to sort of attitudes towards drugs, that's also sort of like been baked into American consciousness since the late 19th century. You know, Chinese opium den sort of users were sort of maligned in the late 19th century, but morphine was highly available in different patent medicines in the post-war era. Heroin was, of course, demonized, while benzodiazepine and barbiturate use was fully normalized. Cocaine and crack, I think, as most people know, are pretty much the same substance, but they've got wildly different connotations. So this has been a long-standing distinction. As far as why amphetamines took off in the post-war period, I mean, it should be said first that methamphetamine took off in the post-war period as well. Smith, Klein, and French, which was the company that first released Benzedrine in 1933, they released racemic amphetamine in their product, and they had a patent on it, which is why they aggressively defended it. But there were, from the beginning, competitors that used dextroamphetamine, which eventually was released in the form of dexedrine, methamphetamine, which was released in the form of methadrine. I think it's dizoxin today. I'm not sure. So, you know, a wide variety of amphetamines were introduced in the post-war period. For anyone who's taken amphetamines, I think the benefit's pretty obvious. They make you peppy. They make you more alert. They sort of allow you to get through possibly rote tasks during the day with a kind of unjustifiable enthusiasm. They're kind of miracle drugs in a way. And despite the fact that they have clear negative consequences, I don't think it takes a great deal of explanation to understand why they're so useful today. Like, they do all of the things that capitalist society wants us to do. And as long as that's true, I think that they're going to be mainstays of American society.
Yeah, it's always one that surprises students when we get to amphetamines and methamphetamine. And you mentioned this in the book, the date's later than I thought. I think you say it was 1965 before methamphetamine was actually taken completely off of over-the-counter availability in any form. That just blows people's minds that not only used to be wink, wink, you could get it, but it used to be pretty easy to get it. And it was packaged and sold as diet pills, energy pills. We're entering, we don't have to go too deep into this, but now that amphetamines and methamphetamine have lost some of their luster, and of course the renamed ones, they hit a little better because you don't have to look it right in the face, but pharma doesn't just stop at that point. The game has always been, okay, cool, it's on the bad list. Let's figure out what was good about it, repackage it, and if it was PCP and it was the half-life, well, then let's just shorten the half-life and call it ketamine and repackage it, and maybe we can now get one that's on the good list and start all over and get another 7 years. Do you want to say a little bit about the new class of what are being called, what, nootropics?
The nootropics. Virgil, Adrafinil, I think. I'm forgetting all the different names. Modafinil.
Yeah,
I mean, these are drugs that have been extensively tested by the military. In the case of amphetamines, World War II really proved the use of amphetamines to everyone on a worldwide scale. And the military is still very interested in different kinds of stimulants they can use. I think on modafinil, soldiers have been kept up for 85 hours straight, which is really unthinkable to me. 85 hours straight of being awake. And, you know, the promise of modafinil as opposed to the amphetamines is that it doesn't make you quite as jittery. So amphetamines, like coffee or anything, sort of like make you kind of jittery, a little bit shaky. They also require some recovery time. So if you're, you know, on an amphetamine binge, you probably need some sleep to sort of like recover afterwards. With modafinil, they found that one, it doesn't make you quite as jittery, but two, you don't need quite the recovery time. And so they'd keep pilots up for days and then they'd only need 8 hours of sleep and they could go back to doing what they were doing. You know, I'm not fully up on the modafinil literature, but I have seen indications that, not surprisingly, it's not quite the miracle drug that they say it is.
Yeah, me either. Yeah. I actually am in our episode description. I was reading an article from Vice about one of their publishers who decided to get some and take it. And I think he's somewhere where it's legal, so he could just go to the store and buy it. I'm not sure if all these chemicals still are here or not, but it reminded me of what a lot of people feel with kratom, this really intense focusing. You can pay attention to a task, but it's at the expense of all of the other things that you would have been going to get your dopamine for the day or your connection for the day. So he said, people just annoyed me. An email would come up and instead of being like, oh, I'd be like, oh, right, and didn't want to eat. And so it's the story of drugs forever. There's always a reaction for every action. And second, we're always in capitalism. Again, one of the big themes of your book, as much as we feel like, ooh, a new big thing, that's what capitalism is. It sells us the same damn movie 47 times in a row, and we're so dumb. We go see every Star Wars that comes out, and we're like, I wonder what this one's about, because that's just the framework of living in the United States. We feel like it must be the next big thing, and lo and behold, we find out later, oh, when we said they only had to sleep 8 hours, we were only testing a certain group of 18 to 23-year-olds. You know, they still were high. So 4 days later, we noticed then they all crash out. It's hard to believe that any of the promises being made aren't much like the promises made in the past about methamphetamine or LSD.
Yeah, I mean, with that in mind, though, I do want to make one clarification, which is that one possible objection to like my argument here is that, well, look, if it's capitalism, right, per se, that is spurring both sort of like drug consumption and drug vilification, why in the post-war period, when you got the New Deal order and a kind of great interruption in capitalism, where you had a prosperity that was widely shared in by the working class, why then did you have escalating drug use, like across the board, amphetamines, benzodiazepines, barbiturates, cigarettes, coffee, et cetera. Like, why in the post-war period was that such a moment of fabulous drug use? And in the, you know, in the relevant chapters and the introduction, the basic argument is that while the post-war period was prosperous, it was affluent, it was not, the sort of affluence was predicated on breaking the back of left-wing trade unionism and politics. And as a result, you know, working people, they had money, right? They had security, but they did not necessarily have control over what they felt was an increasingly bureaucratized world. And so in the face of that, you, when you have security, but you don't have much control over your own life, you know, you want things that help you adapt to what you can recognize is a real material security. Yeah. And I think that's what the drugs provided. You know, this is why amphetamines and benzodiazepines were practically adult candy in the post-war period, because they helped you adapt to what you understood was a materially secure life, but which one which you weren't necessarily happy with.
Do you use the term sublimation in the book? I feel like you probably did at some point. And if not, I am
one who's prone to use the word sublimation. Yeah. I can't remember doing so in the book, however.
But I feel like it's even, I mean, it's worth just briefly touching on what you're laying out is the nice friendly story, but it's a lot deeper than that. Like, we're evolved species that have been on the planet from somewhere between 100,000 to 150,000 years in some form. And we have never lived in a way that says, when I'm anxious today and I need some fulfillment, it was always go find something to kill and eat raw, or go find somebody from another tribe to have sex with. Or it was urges that now we live in a world that, like, we're programmed up that we want stuff. And it doesn't matter how much money we have, we still have desires and long-term goals, and they don't ever hit and fulfill the way that we feel like they're promised. And this is a point you make throughout the book in probably better words than I'm using, but it's so natural in those moments of feeling like, well, what the fuck? I don't feel, to turn to something that turns the volume up to 11 and get the exact same chemical feeling or a related chemical feeling that you may have got from something that is no longer available to humans. And that honestly, we might not want. We might not want to go back to it. I certainly wouldn't want to go back to a world where everybody just goes out and, like, kills stuff with their bare hands to get a rush or whatever, right? Do with that tangent what you will.
Yeah, I mean, skipping ahead a little bit, like, to the conclusion, but I sort of review why I think drug prohibition and that sort of, like, you know, cutting down on supply, distribution, demand, why all those things are sort of, like, bound to fail, and why the sort of fantasy behind prohibition doesn't make sense. But I also sort of attack liberal drug reformism. I think that a lot of the justifications for legalization today don't hold a lot of water if you're talking about actually sort of addressing problems of drug consumption and abuse at their source. And I think part of that is that, I mean, part of what I want to say there is that we need a free relationship to drugs. We don't just want to cut down on all of the perverse things that have followed from the war on drugs. I think that we also want to think about a different kind of social environment wherein people feel less compulsion to use drugs at the same time. You could have medically pure drugs out there with perfectly safe routes of administration and safe environments. I think that in that case, even if a sort of, like, liberal drug policy dream was realized, you'd still have a kind of, like, tragedy of drug use today. And that's because people feel compulsions to use drugs in their everyday lives that aren't just about the perverse incentives of the drug war. It's not just about drugs, that drugs are always about more than drugs. They're about the kinds of, like, issues we're dealing with in our lives. And those issues have to be dealt with if we want to deal with the drug problem.
Well, that's a fine breaking point, because the next step in our progression is to what we're kind of calling the medicalization model in SSRI. So why don't we talk a bit more about what you see as the solution? Because I was expecting to disagree with you, and I totally understand why you said some of your friends were like, this feels like you're anti-drug, but I didn't get that impression at all. I got the impression that you're recognizing we're a damn pendulum culture that always, when we change our mind, goes way too far and then has to yank it back, and then we yank it. It takes us four or five times with a policy to find the sweet spot. And you're saying, for God's sake, people, don't just make it worse so that all the naysayers can say, see, And you're right. If the reason people are using drugs is that they feel to an extent like they're living in some sort of hell or some sort of uncomfortable environment they can't get comfortable at or as comfortable any other way, and you just give them the drug, but the environment still feels like that, you're absolutely right that we're going to have very much the same thing. But can you unpack a bit more about what you think the solution might look like?
So before I get there, I just wanted to provide like a concrete instance of what you're talking about, right? Because I agree with you completely that like it's not the drugs, it's the use of drugs in American society that is really concerning. And in fact, like one could say that like the critique is launched from a position of wanting better kinds of drug use, right? Like drug use where it's actually about sort of human flourishing. And I think that there's no sort of case study for the sort of like degradations of drug use in capitalist society as that of psychedelics.
You know? Yeah, so I like this. Now we're going backwards. So this is, we'll pretend we planned it this way. But yeah, this is great. So
great.
Yeah,
sorry. So psychedelics are, you know, kind of unclassifiable drugs. Like, and I think that explorers of psychedelics have always kind of held that, you know, you either try these things or you don't know. They sort of like defy description. They defy classification. They're not uppers and not downers. They're something else, right? And they've always borne a kind of like religious / spiritual connotation to them, right? I think that I broadly agree with this position that they are when used rightly, but even sometimes when used in sort of like more instrumental, narrow ways, revelatory drugs. But the way in which they're being used today is increasingly frightening, right? In the culture, recreationally, they're not being used, you know, they are being used in some cases to sort of like have that countercultural 60s experience. But in a lot of cases, they're being microdosed in such a way as, you know, to better adapt to your job in some Silicon Valley firm, or to like go to a party with people you don't like and get along with people, right? Yeah. So even the substances that are seemingly most at odds with the instrumental logic of capitalist society, even those substances have been adapted to instrumental purposes today, which to me is just a totally wild fact that people are taking psychedelics to go to work. That should be a kind of mind-blowing fact. But even in, and I've written about this elsewhere, but even in its medical uses, there are two models in the sort of like psychedelic renaissance that are prominent. Like one involves a radical reimagining of psychiatric and psychological practice today. The other sort of involves, you know, booting out the old SSRIs and putting in MDMA and LSD and psilocybin and whatnot.
And keep coming back every month. See
exactly.
You next month.
Exactly. You know, personally, I kind of think that that's going to work in some sense, that latter model, just because the psychedelics, I think, are probably just better drugs than many of the SSRIs. But again, it's not being used for exploratory purposes. It's not about sort of human flourishing. It's just renewing a psychiatric model that is, you know, that is inherently flawed. So in both cases, both on the recreational and the medical side, I think the psychedelic story really shows that these substances that could be used for human betterment are really just being sort of deployed towards the end of adaptation.
Yeah, you make this terrifying statement at the end of the article. I've also linked in the shorter examination of a lot of what you cover in the book, so it'll be on the episode description, but you make this point that the LSD for everybody mind-expanding guru that used to be the countercultural Tim Leary getting locked up all the time and fired from his job has turned into capitalism's best friend. There's two models that you said them repeatedly in the book. You go to like this idea with SSRIs, where we can talk briefly about next if we've got time. It says treat it every day and just keep coming back and pay another bill, and I'm sure pharma will be thrilled. And the other model says you go right at the issue. You take some sort of dose that puts you in a place where you, presumably, sometimes with ketamine, I guess you work it out yourself, but with most psychedelics, you're with friends or with a therapist, and you talk through issues that give you new ways to think about them, and thus begins the process of healing. In a week or two or the next day, sometimes you just feel different about the trauma or the anxiety or the depression or whatever it is. And you don't have to keep going back and handing over money. And no one's surprised when capitalism says, well, we prefer the first model. And you're right. Like you said, I have compassion and empathy that at least it gets you through the day. But if we aren't even putting the option out there and making it the central hub, that first of all, this is what you might want to really try, the one-time method, and be prepared for it to move forward. So again, there's a lot there, but it's the medicalization splitting apart from the treatment, or the yeah. one-time treatment, and then also the idea that capitalism, like you said, has showed up and made friends of the people that used to be, of all the drugs you would think, you can't take that and go to the Ford factory with the 2,000-pound press. It is no friend of capitalism. In 2023, capitalism has now grown to a place and evolved to a place where it can work its fingers in there and say, let me take this. And there's where we might all get, once again, in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, the therapeutic use of psychedelics, you know, goes back to the 50s. Psychiatrists and psychologists were well aware that LSD in particular, but also psilocybin and other drugs could be used in a therapeutic setting. But as you say, you know, the sort of like model was essentially one of augmenting therapy, right? It was about communicating something about yourself to someone else. And the drugs were there to help that along, right? It's essentially the sort of like same therapy model, except like accelerated by drug use. And what was curative for them, however, was not the drug itself, but it was the, you know, dissolution of ego barriers, or however you want to describe it, that drugs allowed, that allowed people to communicate something to someone else in such a way that was curative. You know, that's still for many people in the psychedelic renaissance, the sort of like the model that they want to explore. But increasingly, as you get, you know, the Johnson & Johnsons of the world, like entering the psychedelic space, that model is being pushed to the side. And so while I think it will be available for people who want to pay for it, just as psychoanalysis is available for people who want to pay for it today, it sort of seems like the model that's going to be like the model into which psychedelics are going to fit is the traditional psychiatric one. And this will just, you know, sort of renew again psychiatric practice.
Yeah, which I guess there's a silver lining, but it feels like, right, more of the same and letting that same system grow bigger, even though that system is a big part of the original problem that's causing people to have to turn to these substances anyway. One of the reasons, and you make this, I think there's actually a chart of sorts in the book, from the 1880s to the 1930s, we looked at mental illness as something called neurasthenia, and it was we looked at it as like, look around, look at the society, it's busy, you're always being pulled different directions, of course you feel anxious, have this heroin. And from the 1940s to the 70s, you point out, we sort of updated it to think of it as anxiety, but the doctors would still say, for fuck's sake, look at the society, of course you're stressed out. In the 80s until now, one of the big turns that we've had is not only that we've updated the model to depression, but we've started to blame it not on society anymore and keep us thinking that direction, but on this simple, it must be the brain. In the era of SSRIs was born, because you alluded to this earlier, we started to get this model of the brain that it's as simple as figuring out which ketchup or barbecue sauce or which chemical you just need to squirt a little bit more of in there. And then the next thing you know, all the gears will be lubed up. We seem to have lost sight of what the brain and the body really is. So can you say a little bit about that and maybe lead into SSRIs?
Yeah, I mean, it's really easy for me to sort of seem like I'm just against neuroscience per se, but I think I'm against like the uses to which neuroscientific explanations have been put. And yeah, I mean, in the book, I sort of start in the late 19th century again, when a discourse around neurasthenia, or sort of like tired nerves, William James simply called it Americanitis. You know, it was people were just like, something is wrong with this society. And I need to do something about that. And they were actually like pretty honest about the fact that it was like, look, it's urbanization, it's industrial capitalism, it's the sort of like decline of traditional religious values. Like, you know, all these things are playing a role in making me feel the way I feel. And there could be a discourse about, you know, what to do about that. Mm-hmm. And in the post-war period, with the rise of anxiety as this sort of like primary way of capturing that feeling, they were also pretty honest about the fact that it was society at the root of the things that people were going to see psychiatrists for. And so, you know, in one sense, looking at psychopharmacological advertising at the time, in one sense, it's kind of terrifying, because you're like, oh my gosh, it's a horrible society to live in. But on the other hand, it's actually quite refreshing, because they were like, what, like, this is why you feel this way. So there's this famous ad of a woman behind the bars of a bunch of mops, right, in this domestic setting. And it's like, you can't set her free, but you can make her feel less anxious. It's like, okay, that's horrible on the one hand. On the other hand, they're like, this is why she's feeling this way. Yeah. Right. There was at least some reference to environmental factors. And it's kind of true of all post-war advertising. Like, there's no, your brain is this way, and so you must take this drug that helps with serotonin reuptake, whatever. It was all about, like, what kind of stresses are you facing, and how do these drugs help you? And as horrifying as it was, there's something refreshing in that, in speaking about the kinds of environmental factors that lead to drug use. And not that those go away. So, you know, the sort of like famous Prozac advertisements are, of a working mom, like, taking care of the kids and going to work at the same time, right? You can sort of like do and have it all. So there's still that sort of social.
Sometimes, but a lot of times they're just somebody with the gloom over them, and they're with their friends, and they just can't have. It's an interesting point you're making. Those ads have shifted to say, look how good your life is. Everybody else can have fun and you can't. Don't worry, it's your brain.
Yeah, totally. And increasingly you get these funny illustrations of neurotransmitters and neurons, right? And it's just like, as if you're supposed to look at that picture and say, oh, that's why this is happening to me. But, you know, it's been remarkably successful. I mean, people talk about, I mean, you can listen to popular podcasts and hear people talk very confidently about, like, adenosine receptors or whatnot, and, like, take that to be a real justification. And so the biological revolution in psychiatry and the corresponding sort of, like, shift in psychopharmacological advertising to talk primarily about biology and neurology, it's been remarkably successful in the culture in justifying new kinds of drug use. People like having a language through which they can talk about their own suffering. Right. And I think that that's what this, what the biological revolution supplied. Like, people can say, oh, it's this thing that has been bugging me in my life, and that is a really complicated problem to deal with. It's this one thing that I have to deal with, and then I can take care of it. It, like, beyond being chemically satisfying, it's just satisfying in an explanatory sense. You can make sense of your life through this justification.
Yeah, and it's become taboo, although I think that we're probably already entering and moving through the age when it won't be anymore, and SSRIs will move as new things come along, and probably glutamate enhancement drugs on the heels of psychedelics. We'll finally be able to say, look at the research. But it seems like every good book that talks about this nowadays just simply refers to the fact that placebos do the same or better in almost every study that you will look at. And not only that, you don't hear Prozac talk about this, because in their original trial, of course they don't, but in their original trials, they realized a lot of people were getting agitated, so they prescribed Xanax to anybody that was, another benzo to anybody that was agitated. I got prescribed Prozac 10, 15 years ago. My doctor never mentioned this thing called akathisia, which is when some people feel suicidal. Some people I felt like I was tripping acid, but on a really bad day. Like, I just had to stay away from everybody. And when I told my doctor, she said she'd never heard of it. And that's the magic of capitalism nowadays, that this company can manufacture a drug that really clinically doesn't do much, except, as you said, it gives you a way to explain what is going on with you. And when you take this thing that you've been told will cure you, I mean, regardless, it does something for you. It does raise serotonin levels, so of course it does something, but that simplified version of the brain with the barbecue sauce that we're back to seems to not be doing us a lot of favors anymore.
This is, again, a case where the sort of official justifications, like, enter into, like, actual practices. So the way in which Prozac in particular was sold to the public is, like, it makes a brain normal, right? Like, there's some abnormality, pre-existing abnormality, and what Prozac does is it makes it normal. Well, within that justificatory space, if something goes wrong, then it must just be something else, right? It must be some other unconnected thing, because you're now in a state of normalcy, right, that you need to be treated for. And this is where you get cascading, like, drug prescriptions. And so, like, oh, the Prozac, well, there's another problem. Well, like, here's the Xanax, right? It's a very common story where you're put on one drug, this causes other issues, you get another drug. And rather than sort of holistically understanding the entire range of effects a particular drug might have. Yeah, and it's, again, really, not that this was ever not a problem in the pharmaceutical industry, but especially when everything's reducible theoretically to neurotransmitter sort of actions, that kind of reduction is really, really prevalent.
Feels so good, though. That's back to that quick fix triple entendre that you use, is that it just is so much easier to think of things that way and fix them. Oh, took my pill today. And indeed, it works. It's just the concern is that if we move to where for the next 10 years, we start having news stories and articles about the truth of SSRIs, all those people that have been getting benefits whose belief then starts to subside are prone to now have to just move on to the next thing.
I should also say like one thing about quick fix. As someone who has gone on YouTube and found a lot of DIY home repairs, a quick fix is a real fix. Right? Like they work. They do the thing that you want them to do. The question though, in the long term is like, how many quick fixes can you stitch together and have like a sustainable structure? So
yeah,
I don't want to say like, oh, well, like it's just a quick fix. It's not real or something. Like quick fixes are real fixes. They do something for us.
When I picked the book up, I thought quick fix was just an allusion to when I was shooting dope back in the day and I had to run into a bathroom and take a quick fix. And it is in a lot of ways because it's a book about drugs, but yeah, it's this word magic where somebody can take a term and sort of run with it through the book, but use it different ways. Do you want to, I know we're running out of time. I want to make sure I don't keep you too long, but do you want to try to explain a little bit about the, I feel like there's a big connection here. I want to look at the name, the title of the article, Monsters of the Brain, Images of Deity, Psychology and Religion in the 18th Century.
Sure. Yeah, that was an article I wrote a few years back for a project that has since been abandoned, but which I might take up one day again. I'm still happy with the article itself, though. And there I, you know, go back to the 18th century and look at the genesis of the concepts of both religion and psychology. And I mean, the basic argument is just that these two terms were kind of co-delimiting in the discourse. And so you get a new sort of understanding of religion separate from just Christianity or Christendom, right? It's not just about this sort of all-pervasive fact about life and more about discrete entities of thought, right? This is sort of rising sectarian violence and different schools of thought. And people were trying to make sense of, okay, like, well, how do we tell what's true and what's false in religion, right? How do we distinguish actual faith from instances of superstition and enthusiasm? And it was a very urgent social and political task at the time, right? They're trying to figure out how to navigate this conflicting world of thought. And one thing that was very useful is a sort of like nascent psychology where they're like, okay, well, here's one explanation for why some people fall prey to enthusiasm or superstition. And it's because they, you know, because they give into irrational fears or whatnot, or because they're like manipulated by priestly authorities or something like that. And so psychology, you know, at this time, it sort of is formed around trying to make sense of instances of false religion. And once the sort of idea of religion per se sort of solidifies, it in turn sort of like shapes what people think of as the sort of like psychological realm. And so I wanted to say that these two terms are sort of interwoven in a way that sort of like really makes the histories of religious studies and psychology intertwined. Like modern religious studies, you know, it's sort of divorced itself from its origins in like Mircea Eliade and whatnot. Like they don't want to think in terms of like archetypes or psychological understandings of religion, right? That's all from like a previous age that was problematic in all sorts of ways. But in the article, I wanted to say there's a good reason why these two things went together, psychology and religion. And to some sense, I mean, in some sense, I think a psychological understanding of religion is true to what religion first sort of appeared as in the 18th century.
The theme that runs through both is this, my audience has heard me talk about McLuhan before and his big idea of the medium being the message, but that things show up in society and you need tools to understand them or to study them. And so new areas show up. But once the world changes, that inevitably changes what it means to be a human, how we think about things like religion. The Cult of Pharmacology book that we mentioned earlier, his big thing was talking about the term drugs, the idea of drugs, and that it isn't really what we think it is nowadays. It used to be if in a Toby Seddon is another author who's written about this and said, if you would have said in 1900, I'm going to take some drugs, somebody would have looked at you and said, what the hell are you talking about? They didn't have a concept, anything like we have. Drugs doesn't mean bad chemicals. It means all the media you've seen, all the terrible stories you've heard about crack. You'll go to prison, you're a criminal. It means all of the stereotypes and ideas about drugs that you have in your head. But that frames what it means to be a human when it's Friday and you feel like capitalism and everything else is weighing down on you and you need some relief. Where do you go? Well, you go to the place where it's not, quote, drugs. You go to the bar and get a legal substance.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things that drew me to the project. Drugs and drug discourse in so many ways is sort of like self-bounded, like people talk about drugs as if it's its own sort of like freestanding category. Like it's about chemical actions and how you feel, and it's a very personal thing, right? And I think, you know, for most people, drug experiences are very personal. But what's interesting about drugs, of course, is that they reveal an entire social and political landscape, that it's always about more than drugs. In the introduction of the book, in addition to sort of outlining the basic narrative, I also offer five orienting claims. And the last one is just that drug policy is not about drugs. Like when people talk about drugs, they're always talking about something more than drugs.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that's sort of what's interesting about the project. It's about drugs, but you can sort of talk about drugs while also revealing the contours of American society at the same time.
Yeah, through and through and all the way back to our roots. So this was really fun. I appreciate it. I imagine our paths will cross sometime in the future. That was Ben Fong. And you can find links to all of his work and his fabulous book discussed throughout this episode in the episode description. Thanks to him for the chat, and thanks for listening. Love yourselves and the addicted people in your life. I'm Ben Boyce. It's a good fucking book. I have a book about drugs, and I'm always just like hurt when I, not hurt, there's a better word, but like step your game up, Ben, when I read somebody's book and I'm like, oh, God damn, this is good. But it's a page turner. So you got my,
I appreciate that.